Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller, and this is the Thread Book Hour. Twice a month, I'll bring you some of my favorite interviews with authors, Tracy Mumford's Ask a Bookseller, and some must-read book picks. Today, two writers who developed their rich imaginations and creativity in other lands and other cultures and washed up on our Midwestern shores. Ewan Kerr's interview with Neil Gaiman is up a bit later. But I'm beginning with writer Leslie Nneka Arima. She grew up in Nigeria until she was 13, when her family moved to Louisiana. But along the way, the stories her father was sharing with her ignited an interest in the mysteries of the relationships we share with our parents. Her new story collection dedication reads, "For My Father, Thank You for Telling Me Your Stories." Leslie Nneka Arima's new collection is titled What It Means When a Man Falls from the Sky, and she's with me in the studio. And welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
My grandfather, my Grandpa Miller, was the big storyteller in our family. And when he would tell us stories, as he did from the time that we were little kids, me and my brother would star in those stories that he would tell. And I was curious, and given the fact that you dedicated this book to your father, whether you starred in his stories or whether he was telling you about his life.
The stories my father told were about his life, and we didn't hear them as children. These were stories that he, I think, felt comfortable telling once we were adults. And a lot of the stories were about his experiences in the war.
And this is the war in Nigeria.
Yes, the Biafra War, the Nigeria's only civil war. And I think that he was trying to bury the stories, and I think that that's something that you see a lot with Nigerian families who went through the war, where there's a culture of silence around it, where a lot of parents just don't talk about their experiences, and I think they don't want their experiences to taint their children, right? Yes. They want their children to sort of live beyond it, but it never quite happens that way. It's always like a specter in your childhood that there's something, you know.
That's an interesting phrase that you just used, live beyond it, meaning in some ways, and maybe many immigrant families feel this way, there was suffering, we lived it, we don't want you to have to be influenced, your childhood to be influenced by that.
Exactly. And I think that that was the approach that my parents took. But I mean, it's also a hard thing to do, because we knew things. I mean, my father has a bullet scar in his leg from when his leg was almost taken off. And it was sort of hovering above our childhood, these experiences that our parents lived through.
As kids, were you afraid to ask about the bullet scar for fear of what he might tell you, or for fear that he wouldn't tell you anything?
No, there wasn't really any fear. It was just like, oh, Daddy has a bullet scar. It was just a thing that he had in his leg from when he was in the war. The story didn't go beyond that. And we didn't know, I mean, I didn't know until later that he was 13 at the time. I think he wanted us to become adults without those stories, but, you know, eventually it leaked. I mean, you can't put a top on something like that.
How old were you when he started to tell you the things that had happened to him when he was a kid in Nigeria?
Oh, gosh. I cannot pinpoint the exact age. I just sort of remember the stories just happening slowly and slowly. They become more detailed. So the bullet wound he got in the war, and then, oh yes, he was 13 when he was snatched off the road. And like, it's just the stories became more and more complex as the years progressed, and until as an adult you get the full story. Right?
Do you feel like you know the full story?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that there's always something that gets held back with every oral telling of a story, right? You can't ever truly know how it happened unless you were there. And so I think that we know probably as much as he remembers of it.
You know, I feel like in the telling, the writing of a short story, that's true too.
I believe so, yes.
So you're consciously holding some things back. in these stories that you've written in this collection.
I do, yes. I feel like with short stories or with any stories, you know, that appears on the page, there has to be a sense that this story started before it appeared on the page and it continues after it's done. And so I always write with that in mind that, yes, you know, these characters are here on the page now, but they existed before I started writing them and they will continue to exist after. And so the stories have to have a sense of that breath.
Okay, so this is the thing that I think is so admirable about people who know how to write a short story well, like you do. The knowledge of the background and the knowledge of that story that happened before I ever joined the story as a reader, but not the temptation to put a lot of that background in, to explain, to tell me things I don't necessarily need to know.
Yeah, and that is a very strong temptation as a writer because you very much want your reader to get it. And I think that when you start writing, you think that the way to get the reader to get it is to tell them every single thing, right? Yeah. Which is not, you know, this is not how we naturally even come to know each other. You know, if you start a conversation with someone, they don't tell you their life from
exactly.
birth to death, right? They answer questions, they take cues from what's happening in the environment. And so the stories have to be responsive in that way.
Yeah. And yet, I think that's part of the trust that develops between the reader and the writer. I have that awareness that I joined this life, this story, mid-story, and I am going to trust that you will tell me as much as I need to know. Do you think about the kind of trust of the reader that you're holding in your hands?
Well, now that you've brought it up, I mean, I think of what the story needs and what the story needs to be coherent. That in a roundabout way is thinking about what the reader needs. And for me, it's important that a story is only as coherent as it has to be.
What does that mean?
In that, you know, it doesn't have to be explained. It doesn't have to be completely parsed out or spoon-fed to the reader. I think I trust the reader to sort of get what I'm saying without, you know, my having to shove it in their face. Or, you know, I think that readers are smarter than some writers give them credit for.
What's unique about this, though, is you're taking us back and forth between different geographies and different cultures and different people. I mean, again, you are trusting us to travel with you and understand wherever we go with you.
Yes.
This is a little different, what I think you're doing in this collection, than maybe what other collections do.
Well, I don't want my writing to be educational. That's one thing. I don't feel the desire to sort of, for example, educate the reader about Nigeria, because that's not, I mean, you know, they're history books for that.
Well, what would be wrong with doing that, though?
Well, I think that it's sort of a burden that's put on writers from marginalized culture, that we have to sort of lead the reader to, you know, understand us and learn, you know, learn a different culture, when I think that, you know, we also like to play. We also like to, you know, to play with craft and storytelling and character. And so, you know, I don't believe that, you know, stories from, you know, quote unquote marginalized cultures need to educate a reader, because at that point, you know, who are you writing for? You're writing for yourself, or you're writing to the service of the character, or are you writing to satisfy a reader's curiosity?
And yet, if I get educated along the way,
that's
totally
okay, fine,
right?
Yeah,
that's you're totally, okay with that.
I'm okay with. I'm okay with that.
Are you an only daughter, or do you have siblings?
I have siblings. I'm actually one of five.
Boys or girls?
There are two girls and three boys. I have older twin siblings and younger twin siblings. So I'm the middle child.
You are the only twin? Oh my gosh.
The only non-twin.
That's right. You're the only non-twin. Okay, that is fascinating.
Yeah, I always thought that I was either destined to be an artist or a serial killer. Like, there's no there's no way around it.
So far, it looks like you turned out on the artist side. But who knows? No, you know what else is interesting about that is, the twins we think of as having that special world that they occupy.
Yes.
And you being in the middle of two of those worlds. I mean, did you feel shut out to some degree?
I mean, I was very angsty. So, yes.
Yeah?
Like, I was quite the angsty teenager. And so I did. But I mean, you know, we're all very close and also close in age, too, and just close in general. But yes, I mean, there is no denying that there was that separation. And you know, my mother always used to tell me that she was my twin, and that was her way of comforting me.
That's a wonderful way to comfort you. Okay, I asked you that because I found your observations in these stories about what exists between fathers and daughters really poignant. So what I thought I would do is ask you to read a paragraph at the beginning of the story Light, and then maybe we can talk about that.
Sure.
And how that fits in with your own upbringing in the midst of twins. This is from the collection What It Means When a Man Falls from the Sky. I'm talking with Leslie Nneka Arima, and this is the Thread Book Hour. She's about to read an excerpt from the collection.
Light. When Enabili Okwara sent his girl out in the world, he did not know what the world did to daughters. He did not know how quickly it would wick the dew off her, how she would be returned to him, hollowed out, relieved of her better parts.
When I asked you to read that, you said that's a favorite passage.
Yes.
To read. Why?
Well, the story is one of my favorites, only because it was one of those sort of serendipitous stories that happened very quickly. And also, it was a story that I think that I had been trying to write, but never actually approaching the page with it. And so, you know, when I write, I tend to let stories brew, and they brew for quite a while. And then when I'm ready, I write them out. And this was one that I didn't even know was there until it appeared. And so it's a father-daughter story that I had been wanting to write for quite a while.
And because we should say what the story is about.
Oh, yes.
It's a father and a daughter and a mother who is overseas in the United States, getting her schooling. And she's left the father and daughter for what she thinks is only going to be a couple of years.
Right.
And their lives are changing.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, the story sort of explores, this father sort of trying to contend and protect this vivacious young daughter of his, and, you know, sort of his confusion with that.
Yeah. I mean, do you think it's more, this is why I asked you about where you are in your siblings. Mm-hmm. Do you think it's more fearsome for a father to try to raise a daughter alone or with a mother in the house than it is to raise a son?
I don't know. I think that, you know, every child comes with their own challenges. I do think that with girls, there are more rules for girls, and because of their more rules, there's sort of less leeway for what makes a good girl.
Ah,
right?
Yeah.
And so I think that in the sense that's more challenging. Yeah.
Do you think with your parents' background that the idea of what makes a good girl was different had you stayed in Nigeria than the way you would describe that here?
Well, I mean, I don't think the definition changed for them. Like they are Nigerian through and through. And so
what is the definition of a good girl in Nigeria?
That's a very hard question. it's no different than what you would think of. How would you describe a good girl in any sort of middle class, any sort of middle class background? What would be considered a good girl? And then middle class, and then add an extra layer of religiosity.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
And so, I mean, it's nothing that's unfamiliar to anyone.
Is the religiosity, is it Catholicism or what is it?
It was, and then it sort of morphed into evangelical sort of Pentecostalism, sort of along that vein.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And so did your parents bring that with them to Louisiana, or it deepened in Louisiana?
My mother opened a church in Louisiana.
Fascinating.
I like to think of, we were sort of reverse missionaries.
Gosh. What kind of a church?
A non-denominational Christian church. Yeah. And so, So like those are the definitions we're working with.
Well, you can't stop there, Leslie. There's much more to know about that. Did she do that because she felt that what community were you in Louisiana when you came here?
I don't think we really, I mean, Louisiana, we moved to Lafayette, which was not a small town, but not quite a big city either. And so, you know, there weren't any, like there wasn't a Nigerian community there, for example. And so.
So did your mother think the churches in this community cannot meet my needs and the needs of people I think need to be ministered to? Or was this always an ambition of your mother's to open
a
church?
She opened a church in Nigeria, so this was just another branch of the church.
Wow.
It just seemed natural. Well, she has her own church in Nigeria. She moves here.
She's a powerful woman.
Yes.
And how did the community respond when she opened it?
We started off as part of a church. We didn't open up her church right away.
Okay.
There was a lot of resistance because I think it was, in the Southern Baptist tradition, women did not lead churches. And so there was a lot of resistance to that. But eventually, by the time my mother left to start her own church, the male pastor of this Southern Baptist church sort of like gave his blessing to the endeavor. But
go ahead.
No.
Yes.
I mean, there's not much else to say. It was just part of, for her, it was just sort of a continuation of the mission that she, for her life. Yeah.
I mean, I said that she's a powerful woman because I think it takes, just as I think it takes something unique to believe that you should represent people in Congress or you could be president, to be the person that feels a particular call to say, I have a special skill and understanding in calling, and that requires that I open this church, is a pretty unique personality trait.
Yes. Yes, it is. Yeah. I think we lucked out with having her as our mother.
As your mother?
Yeah.
So does she still run a church?
She's no longer with us. But I say lucked out because... I think that, I wouldn't have thought about this as a child growing up, but, she sort of modeled the idea that, their women didn't necessarily have a small space to occupy.
Mm-hmm.
Like as a woman, you could occupy a larger space.
Would that have been the case in Nigeria?
I mean, she had a church in Nigeria, too. I do think that... I do think that in Nigeria, the rules are for women are a little, they're a little more strict. And so I think that she would have been able to, she did have a church in Nigeria, and so that wasn't a problem. But I don't know, that sort of dynamic is something that I think that she would probably have been, would be able to speak to with more authority.
This is so interesting because I started off talking to you about this poignant relationship between the father and daughter, and then I learn all this about your mother. That's right. Then we come back to mothers. But here's the thing that I wondered in reading some of these explorations that you're doing between daughters and parents, if especially when it comes to fathers, do you think fathers are fully aware of how influential they are, for good or bad, in their daughters, in the eventual romantic partners that their daughters will choose?
I don't know. That's a question that I would think I would actually like to ask my father if he is aware. I think it's something that men should be asked, because I could only speculate about
speculate about your own dad.
I don't think that fathers are all that aware. And I think that parents, they do their best to raise us, to be, functioning adults. But there's little sort of awareness of the emotional aspect of when we are adults, what we then look for in
right.
partners. I don't think right. that is something that parents think about.
I mean, yeah. what we're soaking in and learning.
Yeah.
I'm curious about this too, about my own parents, because as it turned out, I ended up marrying somebody who has a lot of qualities that my dad has, but I don't think that's something that they were fully aware of when I chose. Mm-hmm. I've been in a long marriage now. I'm always curious about whether parents look back and go, I saw that coming.
Right. Yeah. I don't think they do.
You're listening to the Threadbook Hour. I'm Carrie Miller, and this is an interview with Leslie Neka Arima about her new story collection, What It Means When a Man Falls from the Sky. I think that story, Light and the one that you read the excerpt from and a number of the short stories that you've put in this collection are talking to the reader about what it's like to live between a couple different worlds. You're interested in that, I get the sense. Is that right?
Not consciously. Yeah, I don't think
really?
I don't think I realized how much of that I was doing until until it was pointed out to
wow.
me. But I am interested in the idea that, you know, we are occupying a different world than our parents did.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way that they navigate the world, is that going to be useful for us? Like, I think that's something that I think about a lot. And probably comes out in the writing.
Yeah. Would you say something else? I don't know that I'm clear on what you mean by that.
Yeah, I think that sort of speaking specifically about my parents, for example, you know, they grew up in Nigeria in the 70s, in the 70s, 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it was a completely different world than even Nigeria is now. I mean, Nigeria is a country that has progressed very quickly. Mm-hmm. And so it's not something that's unique to Nigeria. It could be, you know, in any country, the world has moved so quickly, you know, with technology, with, you know, becoming globalization. It's become such a different place in such a short amount of time that that our parents don't really have the tools to tell us how to navigate the world now because it's so unfamiliar to what they grew up in.
Do you think that only happens with families like yours, and there's a lot of American families like yours, that the parents have come from somewhere else, the children are really being raised steeped in the American culture, and there is this quality, as you say, that the parents really don't know how to whether what they're doing is going to be useful to their kids, or is that the case for all American
families? I think it's for all American families. I think, you know, if I can use an example, a friend of mine who's from Minnesota, who, you know, she started dating online like maybe 5 years ago, and her parents were just flabbergasted. They thought, oh, this is, you know, you're going to get killed. They just didn't understand that this is a completely different world than the world that, you know, of course, they would never have dreamed of dating online. But, you know, 80, 90 years ago, people were, you know, sending off for brides via the mail. So
well,
it's like,
yeah,
you know, it's true for all families because, you know, and being in an immigrant family that's sort of half based in two different worlds, it just adds another layer of that. But it's the same, I think, everywhere.
Right. Okay. So it's interesting that you were not consciously saying this is an idea, this idea of, and I don't just mean the geographical mm-hmm. locations. You know that. But it's interesting that you were not consciously saying, this is something that has always intrigued me and I want to write about it. But boy, does it come through in your stories.
You know,
so what do you make of that?
I don't like to write stories that I feel are didactic or like trying to make a point about something. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I'm a human being that's engaged with the world and around me. And so it's inevitable that my concerns or the things I think about will sort of seep into the writing and be things that I write about, even though I don't consciously say, oh, this is the message of the piece or whatever.
I get that. But I feel like there is this idea of what, for lack of a better phrase, what home is or mm-hmm. where you feel most centered and yourself.
Yes.
And I feel like you're exploring that idea in some of these stories.
I would say, yes, I would say that I do think about sort of personhood, right?
Okay.
And when does a person become a person or become their own person,
right,
to be more specific. But yeah. And so, and like, that is something that I do think about when I'm writing and sort of thinking about, you know, the character, you know, discovering themselves and, you know, things like that.
So before we went on the air, I was asking you about living in Minnesota.
Yes.
And you said that when you first came here, which was when?
Oh, 2007.
Okay.
Oh, God.
Well, yeah. Longer than you thought.
Yes.
We both acknowledge that we've ended up loving it here and we didn't expect to. So how do you think Minnesota has contributed to that development of you as a person?
Yeah.
Of that personhood, of who you are today?
Well, you know, I don't know sort of what Minnesota's contributed uniquely. But I do know that Minnesota is where I became an adult.
But that's chronological, Leslie. There's more to it.
No, it's not just chronological. Okay, because I was in my 20s when I came for grad school, so I wasn't already technically an adult.
Okay.
Right. But I think that something about the distance from home and just being far from everyone that I knew, like I felt like I was forced to discover exactly like what, you know, who I am, what am I doing. You know, why am I here? and I think, you know, and it's something about, I know there's something about being around people that who don't know you, helps you to discover who it is you actually are. Because, you know, when you are home, you are, you know, there's so much scaffolding there of your childhood and who you were growing up and things like that. Whereas when you move somewhere where nobody knows you, it's like, you finally get to be yourself.
I really like the way you put that, the scaffolding of that. Some of it's expectations, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You've set up a lot of expectations within your family and your circle of friends. And you don't have to be bound by that when you come somewhere like this, that where no one knows you.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that's exactly right, expectations.
How do you think... that development then in a place where no one knew you was different from, let's say you'd stayed in Louisiana, you'd gone to grade school there, you had this circle of friends, your family right there. How do you think it was different?
I think that it allowed me to open up. Because when I first moved to Louisiana, and this when we came from Nigeria, you know, it was a culture shock for me. And so I sort of closed myself off. I closed in, and so I found it difficult to interact with people.
Did you?
Because I was just, again, I was just so uncomfortable. It was such an unfamiliar place. And so I think that in Louisiana, I was sort of stuck in that cycle of just sort of being closed in and unsure. Whereas when I came up here, it was, oh, well, you know, there's like nobody knows me as the quiet. In fact, I think that if most of the people who know me here in Minnesota heard me described as quiet and shy, they'd be quite shocked.
Really? I mean, was that a conscious thing? Like, I'm not going to be that person in Louisiana. Sometimes, you know, an individual makes a this is I'm going to take on this new color and personality when you go to a new place. Was that conscious for you?
No, it wasn't necessarily taking on a new personality, but it was more just sort of escaping a cage, it felt like, almost. And I think that part of, you know, I moved around a lot. Even after we came to the U.S., you know, for college and just to move. And I think that I was sort of running away from what I thought was, again, that was that cage, but, you know, of course the cage came with me, you know, that epiphany that
as
you have.
As it does, right? Right.
And so I think that, you know, so what moving, you know, the distance here sort of finally, I was finally able to sort of break out of that. So I think that was, you know, it was to my benefit to move as far away from home as I did.
I'm curious about, because you described being the middle child between two sets of twins, whether books were a place you could turn to.
Oh my goodness! Or, yeah? Yes, my sister and I, we actually, so when we first moved to Louisiana, we discovered the Lafayette Public Library, and we found out that you can check out up to 50 books a piece. And so we would go with duffel bags. We would go to the library with duffel bags. So we would each check out 50 books. I would read my duffel bag. She'd read her duffel bag, and we'd trade duffel bags.
God, over the course of a couple weeks?
Oh, gosh, yeah.
You'd read 50 books in a couple weeks?
It was all we did. So it was like, it was a summer. It was a summer before we actually started school. And so, you know, it was all we did. I mean, we would read it, go through a couple of books a day, because that's all we did. 20, you know. And so, we read hundreds of books that summer. And, books have always been my salvation. Yeah, my refuge. So, yeah, it was inevitable that I would end up writing Although that's not what I thought at the time. I thought I was going to go to law school.
So glad you didn't become a lawyer.
You know, I think I would have really enjoyed law school, but hated being a lawyer. So that's a good thing, too.
You were meant to be a writer. That's what all that reading was in training for.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
My conversation with Leslie Emeka Arima, her new story collection is called What It Means When a Man Falls from the Sky. You can read about it on The Thread. You're listening to The Thread Book Hour on NPR News Presents, and I'm Carrie Miller. Thread producer Tracy Mumford is here with what booksellers across the country are reading. Hi.
Hello.
Good to be here. What are booksellers reading?
So this one's fun. So this week I talked to a bookseller in Hawaii.
And way to go.
At the Talk Story Bookstore.
In person, or did you have to do this by phone?
It was over the phone and on the way. But it is the westernmost bookstore in the entire United States.
Where
which
is it?
Makes
what
sense.
Island?
It's on Kauai.
I've been to Kauai
there
many times. Where is it?
It's in the Hanapepe neighborhood.
Okay.
So this
is
the Talk Story Bookstore. I talked to Cynthia Justice, and she said that she has been recommending this one fiction book for 10 years. She loves it that much. And it is The Shadow of the Wind by Carlos Ruiz Zafón.
It was originally in Spanish and translated into English. The translation is wonderful. He's a current writer, but this one is takes place in Barcelona, 1945, and without any spoilers, the book basically starts out that a young man comes of age, and as a gift, his father takes him to this vast underground library. And in the library, there's only one book by each author. So after many, many hours, the young man picks his book. And when he gets home and he's reading the book, within the first couple of pages, he must find another book by the same author, and that's where the tale begins. It's a great book for both men and women. The writing is phenomenal. It has everything a good author should have in a novel. A bit of adventure, has a bit of mystery, has the tiniest bit of romantic interest in it, and you go on a journey.
So that was Cynthia Justice at Talk Story in Kauai, Hawaii, recommending this book that she's been recommending to tourists who come from all around the world for over 10 years. She just really loves this book.
Can we take a Thread field trip to this bookstore in Kauai?
I would not say
no. Can we do that?
I would not say no.
Okay, it's a date. I'm Carrie Miller, and this is The Thread Book Hour on NPR News Presents. This week, we're hearing from two writers who grew up overseas and found the Midwest to be a fruitful place creatively. Like Leslie Arima, Neil Gaiman is also a writer who came to the Midwest from overseas. He was raised in the UK, but he ended up writing in a house in rural Wisconsin. His new book is a retelling of the ancient tales of Odin, Thor, and other Norse gods. And although the original stories are over 1,000 years old, they still resonate with audiences. Gaiman told NPR's You and Care that those old myths reveal much about the world today.
So how familiar will these ancient tales sound? Take a listen to Gaiman reading from a story called The Wall.
Thor had gone to the east to fight trolls. Asgard was more peaceful without him, but it was also unprotected. This was in the early days, shortly after the treaty between the Aesir and the Vanir, when the gods were still making a home for themselves, and Asgard was undefended. "We cannot always rely on Thor," said Odin. "We need protection. Giants will come. Trolls will come." "What do you propose?" asked Heimdall, the watchman of the gods. "A wall," said Odin. "High enough to keep out frost giants, thick enough that not even the strongest troll could batter its way through." "Building such a wall," said Loki, "so high and so thick, would take us many years." Odin nodded his agreement. "But still," he said, "we need a wall."
When Gaiman reads that section on tour, he says audiences fall apart, because these old, weird stories talk to us across the years.
They are relevant, and they feel very relevant. Most worryingly for me, when I've been talking to people since the book came out, one of the things that I keep hearing is how incredibly familiar the final chapter is, where we hit Ragnarok, the end of the world. And people are going, well, last night somebody asked, have we reached peak Ragnarok yet? And I had to say, no, I do not believe we are at peak Ragnarok yet. But I can see why. There's a brother against brother quality. As the seas die, as things get dark, as the winter lasts forever. And I think stories like The Wall, there are so many stories that feel oddly contemporary, feel oddly now, perhaps in a way that Greek and Roman mythology feels antiquated. This is the Viking myths are from a harder era, and maybe it's a more appropriate.
Could I ask you to read a section, the part, do you ever wonder where poetry comes from? And tell us a little about Snorri, the guy who actually gathered some of these tales.
Do you wonder where poetry comes from? Where we get the songs we sing and the tales we tell? Do you ever ask yourself how it is that some people can dream great, wise, beautiful dreams and pass those dreams on as poetry to the world, to be sung and retold as long as the sun rises and sets, as long as the moon will wax and wane? Have you ever wondered why some people make beautiful songs and poems and tales, and some of us do not? It is a long story, and it does no credit to anyone. There is murder in it, and trickery, lies and foolishness, seduction and pursuit. Listen.
There's a wonderful element, though, too, that they're very messy. I mean, there are just kind of odd things thrown in that are hugely important, and everyone said, okay, fair enough, yeah, everyone dies, that's current, you know, whatever. And they there's a comfort in that, in a way.
There is. I mean, the weirdness of the Norse mythology, in some ways, is that we have any of it at all. You know, we are lucky that a handful of poems were preserved. We're lucky that Snorri Sturluson wrote his prose Edda primarily in order to explain to the poets of Iceland. And they were written after Christianity had come in, after paganism had been wiped out, what the old stories were in order that they could understand for them classical poetic references. Without these guys, we wouldn't have anything at all. As it is, some of the stories we have are contradictory. We have some stories in the poetic version that is different to the prose version. So, which was actually fun for me as a writer, because I got to pick and choose the bits I liked and whatever felt more appropriate. And you also felt like there were things that were missing. You know that we have the tip of the iceberg of what's left. I grumble in my introduction that there are goddesses particularly that we only know their names. We have no stories. And yet they must have been stories. Eir was the doctor of the gods. Lofn, the Norse god of marriages. Vor, goddess of wisdom. There were loads of them. And yet we mostly got, you know, very, very male tales have survived. Ones with fighting. And you go, yes, but there were more than this.
Strangely enough, I was in Iceland last week and actually saw, I think it was the same Snorri, Snorri's bunker.
Mm-hmm.
Out at the Law Rock. It's strange how very present this stuff feels. I mean, but this has been part of your psyche, clearly, since you were quite young.
I was very lucky. I discovered Thor in a wonderful way, which was reading reprints of the very, very early Jack Kirby, Larry Lieber, Stan Lee, the stories of the Mighty Thor reprinted in an English comic called Fantastic in black and white. And I loved them and was so interested that when I discovered a friend of mine had a copy of a book called Myths of the Norsemen, I read it, and then I borrowed it, and then I read it some more, and then I got my own copy. And read that till the pages fell out. And initially went to the Myths of the Norsemen to learn more about the Thor of the comics, and rapidly realized that the Thor of the comics was its own thing. But the Thor of the myths, the Thor of the stories, and the Loki and the Odin of the stories were much darker, stranger, and more dangerous characters than the ones in the comics. And they fascinated me. I was lucky. I had Roger Lanceling Green when I was a boy. When I hit my early 20s, Kevin Crossley Holland's beautiful retellings of the stories came out. And I read them, and they were what sent me to write the Norse gods into Sandman, the comic series that I wrote for many years. And then I realized that I'd never actually read the Eddas. And I thought, well, I should go back and I should read what Snorri wrote. I should read the Poetic Edda. And I did. And they, in a lot of ways, informed American gods. Although I think one thing that really helped me understand the Norse gods and made them work for me on a level that they would not have worked for me earlier was living out near Minneapolis and experiencing the world in which a winter can kill you if it wants to. And the outside becomes dangerous. And that really threw the Norse myths into focus for me. You know, you look at the stories of the Romans and Greeks, and everybody's sitting around eating grapes, and they, you know, staring at themselves in pools and being naked and warm, and there's honey and there's milk and there's lots and lots of wine. And you go, ah, there's never any indication in these stories that the environment wants you dead. And I think the part of the joy for me of really understanding on a sort of primal level, a lot of the Norse myths was going, ah, yes, these were written in a world in which for 3 or 4 months of the year, the environment wants to kill you. And you are inside a very smoky hall because they had not yet invented chimneys. With your best friends, and you are eating and you are getting very drunk and you are telling stories to survive the winter.
And another thing that struck me when I was in Iceland, which I hadn't really understood before, going back to that thing about the adoption of Christianity, was how much the stories actually were quietly kind of subsumed into the Christian way of doing things. That while Emer says, yes, we're Christian, but quietly in the background, they were carrying around their Thor amulets and their the things. Well, this may be a statue of Thor, but it may also be a crucifix, depending on who you're talking to.
Yep.
And it seems that really, while we may not be quite as aware as we once were, that's still true to a certain extent today.
Well, there was a glorious pragmatism in Iceland, where I have been told by Icelandic historians that they passed a peculiar kind of law. You know, most places in the world made, once Christianity moved in, paganism became illegal, essentially. In Iceland, the law said that it was only illegal if they caught you, which I loved. It was sort of a tacit acknowledgement that people would continue secretly and on their own with some of the practices of the older times. Although you hope not the ones where they would, you know, sacrifice 9 animals over 9 nights to Odin, ending in a glorious sacrifice, you know, beginning with dogs and cattle and ending with people. What they would also do with these old stories is what's called ehumorize them. which is to say they would tell the stories of Thor and Odin and so forth, but they would begin by saying, well, you know, some people mistakenly thought these were gods, but actually they were just living in a town called Asgard. And now let me tell you the funny story of what this guy Thor did living in the town called Asgard. So they were also sort of allowed to tell the stories by ungodding them.
As you went through this material, did any of the particular stories become favorites or going to rise to the top?
There were some odd stories that I hadn't known well or knew vaguely that became new favorites. And oddly enough, the one that you had me read, the Mead of Poetry, is one of the ones that did become a favorite, because it really is a story that does no credit to anybody. And that's part of the joy of it. And it contains several murders and a number of very unpleasant characters and seduction and stuff. And yet, as a story of how poetry reaches the world, you feel the glorious metaphor of we created mead. And mead, this amazing, you know, creating alcoholic drinks. And this is the way that poetry came along with alcohol. Is a glorious metaphor, and the underlying metaphor of, and poetry, you know, this mead is from the blood of the gods, is so beautiful and so odd. And then I think I probably had the most fun of all telling stories like the one about the creation of Thor's hammer, how the Norse got the treasures of the gods, telling the story of how Thor's hammer got stolen and how he was sent off in incredibly unconvincing drag with Loki, who had transformed himself into a beautiful woman, to try and pretend that he was Freya getting married to Thrym, evil lord of the giants, in order to get his hammer back, which you know will not end well for any of the giants. And it's just funny. It's the sort of the glorious raucousness of, you can imagine people again sitting around in a smoky hall and explaining how there's, you know, what the giants think is the beautiful Freya, and only it's Thor wearing a wedding veil and a wedding crown. And every time a plate of food passes by, it disappears under the veil and doesn't come out again. And there's a sort of enthusiasm for life in some of these stories that just delights me.
Right. And along with this new book, Norse Mythology, your, some would say, classic novel, American Gods, has been on TV. You and your mythical characters are having quite a year.
We are. American Gods is one of those strange things. People talk about relevance, and I get fascinated somehow by relevance, especially when people start talking to me about American Gods, as if when I was writing it, you know, 18, 19 years ago, what was uppermost in my mind was going, I need to write something that will be very appropriate and relevant in 2017 when it goes on the television, which was not uppermost in my mind. And yet it does feel tremendously relevant for right now. We end season one just before we reach the house on the rock. So if enough people watch it and like it, we will get to the house on the rock and beyond in season two.
But it's also marvelously wonderful that this book, Norse Mythology, is coming out given the influence that it had on that book.
What I love about a lot of my life is the peculiar coincidences that look as if they are incredibly brilliantly planned out and intentional, and really are just the way that things happened. I had the initial lunch with my editor, Amy Cherry, in November 2008, at which she initially asked me about working on Norse mythology. I started working on it in about 2012. American Gods, the TV series, came together a couple of years ago. I suddenly was happening, and about last April, they started shooting it. And they started shooting it, you know, a couple of months after I'd handed in the manuscript for Norse mythology, which I'd been working on for years. And suddenly here we are with a book that people actually, if you pick up Norse mythology and read it, it will give you hints and clues, and it will get you a little bit ahead of the game on American Gods. But it also existed because my wife, Amanda, had been grumbling to me when she read American Gods that it didn't have an appendix, it didn't have annotations, and she really wanted to know more about who these people were, and she said it made her feel stupid, and she is not stupid. I went, okay, well, let me give you the stories that would make you feel less stupid.
Thank you, and thank you for the book. It's just a lot of fun. It really is. So, shall we wrap it up?
Let's wrap it up. And you are so welcome on the book. I'm hearing you say that it's a load of fun makes me very happy, because that really is what I wanted to do. It's like covering old folk songs. You want to do them so they sound both, you're doing the folk song as best you can, and you're trying to make it sound like something that contemporary audiences would recognize as music and not go, this is a historical thing.
You are my sunshine, my only sunshine. You make me happy when the skies are gray. You never know, dear, how much I love you. Please don't take my sunshine.
That was Neil Gaiman speaking to Ewan Kerr. I'm Carrie Miller, and this is the Thread Book Hour. Do you want to know what I'm reading and loving? You can get the Thread newsletter every Friday by texting the word book to 677-677.